Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Rebuttals are flying fast and furious. Amazing time in our political history. Making fun of tire gauges. And Paris Hilton talking about that old wrinkly white guy.
Yeah.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And should San Francisco be nailing people for not recycling? How'd you feel if you got a $1,000 bill in the mail or a ticket, the equivalent of a ticket? Well, it starts at 50. And for that matter, you know, we now know, the science is in, that eating meat in the United States produces more greenhouse gases than driving all of our cars and flying all of our airplanes. Should we become a nation of vegetarians? Should we place a meat tax? Should we have a fine? Should we have a surcharge? A whole bunch of stuff. But let's start with the really important stuff. John McCain, of course, ran an ad recently basically saying that Barack Obama is just a celebrity, right? He's not really a serious politician. He's just a celebrity because 200,000 people showed up for him in Germany, and people all over the world love him, and people all over America love him, so he must just be a celebrity. And, in fact, Paris Hilton's mother, who has made the maximum, her and her husband have made the maximum donation, $4,400, to the John McCain campaign, came out and condemned McCain for this ad. But in a far more elegant twist, her daughter, Paris Hilton, her new campaign commercial.
Hey, America, I'm Paris Hilton, and I'm a celebrity, too. Only I'm not from the olden days, and I'm not promising change like that other guy. I'm just hot. But then that wrinkly white-haired guy used me in his campaign ad, which I guess means I'm running for president. So thanks for the endorsement, white-haired dude. And I want America to know that I'm, like, totally ready to lead. And now I want to present my energy policy for America. Just as soon as I finish reading this article on where I can fly to get the best tan. Oh, Maui. Loves it. Okay, so here's my energy policy. Barack wants to focus on new technologies to cut foreign oil dependency. And McCain wants offshore drilling. Well, why don't we do a hybrid of both candidates' ideas? We can do limited offshore drilling with strict environmental oversight while creating tax incentives to get Detroit making hybrid and electric cars. That way, the offshore drilling carries us until the new technologies kick in, which will then create new jobs and energy independence. Energy crisis solved. I'll see you at the debates, bitches. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go pick out a vice president. I'm thinking Rihanna. I'll see you at the White House. Oh, and I might paint it pink. I hope that's cool with you guys. Bye. I'm Paris Hilton, and I approve this message because I think it's totally hot.
There you go. I think it's great. I think it's absolutely great. Making fun of the old that old white-haired guy. Yeah. Yeah. And the problem, you know, the sad thing is that John McCain is getting increasingly incoherent, and Paris Hilton is sounding really coherent. Now, you know, I don't agree with her energy policy. I mean, her, you know, let's drill over the short term so that over the long term we can have energy and tax incentives. Sounds nice. The problem is drilling over the short term doesn't produce any energy for a decade. But nonetheless, hey, it's a good, you know, it sounds good, and it's a nice first step. By the way, today is a significant anniversary. A couple of dates. Number one, 7 years ago today, George Bush was sitting in at his hobby ranch in Crawford, Texas, the one he bought just before he ran for president, and the one that he has already said he is going to abandon as soon as he leaves the presidency and go back to a mansion in Dallas. Anyhow, Bush was sitting at his mansion in Crawford, his hobby ranch. You can't call it a ranch, really, because ranches have horses, and he's afraid of horses, as Vincente Fox, the former president of Mexico, pointed out to us. But in any case, today, 7 years ago, the CIA flew a guy down, and the fellow showed up and said, Mr. Bush, Osama bin Laden is determined to strike inside the U.S. Hand-delivered this memo to Bush. Condi Rice was there. And this from the 9/11 Commission findings, page 260, quote, President Bush did not recall discussing the August 6th report with the Attorney General or whether Condoleezza Rice had done so. She at that time was the National Security Advisor, and who was not doing anything about national security. Can you imagine if 10 months into your presidency and you had done absolutely nothing about Osama bin Laden or about the possible threat that he represented, after the Clinton administration had been running around like crazy, if Al Gore had been president and 9/11 happened, to this day he would be tarred as the guy who let it happen. Well, Bush is the guy who let it happen. And this is the day when he got the memo. And then also the 9/11 Commission report on page 262, we found no indication of any further discussion before September 11th among the president and his top advisors of the possibility of an al-Qaeda attack on the United States. No further discussion from this day, 7 years ago, with the day that he received the infamous memo saying bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. and 9/11 when the strike actually happened. In fact, according to the 9/11 Commission, the day that he received the memo, quote, Bush seemed carefree as he spoke about the books he was reading, the work he was doing on his nearby ranch, his love of hot weather jogging, his golf game, and his 55th birthday. Excuse me, this is the Washington Post said that. Now it's 2,557 days later, and guess who is still running around on his camel with his dialysis machine, carefree, footloose, and fancy free? Yes, Osama bin Laden. It's also today, speaking of anniversaries, today is also the day in 1945 that a Japanese, at 6:15, 8:16 a.m. Japanese time, that an American B-29 bomber, the Enola Gay, dropped the world's first atomic bomb over the city of Hiroshima. 80,000 people died immediately, 35,000 injured, another 60,000 were dead by the end of the year as a consequence of fallout. People are still dying as a result of that explosion. This was a terrible day, a terrible day in the history of the world. And, and something that's still being debated. You know, was it an appropriate way to end the war? It appears that actually the Japanese were on the verge of being willing to surrender anyway. Truman wanted to do this to send a message to at least this is my opinion of the history of it. I know others will disagree. I think Truman did this because he wanted to send a message to Stalin to say, you know, we've got this. Don't mess with us. But who knows? In any case, 80,000 people, mostly civilians. This is, you know, war, civilian targets. I mean, this is just a terrible thing. So, a conservative alert. Dick Cheney's argument for why Hamdan and others should not be released. They'll just get lawyers. Yeah, seriously. That's what he said in a White House meeting. Well, at the end of 2005. This is described in Jane Mayer's new book, The Dark Side. She says, by the end of 2005, those defending the regime of torture were no longer seeking primarily to protect the search for valuable intelligence. They were fighting for its survival in the face of considerable evidence of the failure of SEER and other programs because they feared being prosecuted should the program be halted and exposed. Even releasing detainees whom they knew to be entirely innocent was dangerous. Since once released, they could talk. As Dick Cheney said in a White House meeting, people will ask where they've been and what have you been doing with them. They'll all get lawyers. And, in fact, Hamdan. The Hamdan case went to the Supreme Court. Yes, this guy has to have a trial. Well, it's a military jury. Began deliberations. This is Salim Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's former driver. Which raises questions, by the way. Well, let me finish that sentence. His former driver, they're saying, even if this guy is acquitted, Even if the military jury finds that he had nothing to do with 9/11 or any attacks against Americans, they're still not going to let him out of jail because George Bush has declared that he's an enemy combatant. By his crime, apparently, being the driver of Osama bin Laden. Which raises the question, should anybody, is the court in The Hague? Are the folks who may be bringing charges against the Bush administration in The Hague, are they keeping track of the names of the Secret Service drivers of George W. Bush? I mean, just consider how absurd that is. Did we go after Hitler's driver? Did we go after Mussolini's driver? Did we go after Franco's driver? Did we go after Tojo's driver? And yet here is this guy who was the driver for Osama bin Laden. And they're saying, well, even if he's acquitted, he would still be considered an enemy combatant and would therefore be subject to continued detention. To hell with habeas corpus. To hell with the rule of law. This is the Bush administration, after all. We don't need no stinking constitution. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Conflicts of global corporate interest. This is the Tom Hartman radio program. Well, should San Francisco and should every city in America be charging people, be dinging people if they don't properly recycle? Garbage collectors would inspect San Francisco's residence trash to make sure pizza crusts aren't mixed in with chip bags or wine bottles under a proposal by Mayor Gavin Newsom. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle. John Cote, Chronicle staff writer, if residents or businesses don't separate the coffee grounds from the newspapers, they could face fines of up to $1,000 and eventually have their garbage service stopped. You know, we really do have an amazing problem here in the United States. 70% of San Francisco's waste is going to landfills rather than being recycled. And their goal is to have zero waste by 2020, 75% reduction, only 25% going to the landfills by 2010. And the bottom line is they're saying the only thing that's going to move people is cash. Now, this is also the city that has outlawed smoking in parks and feeding pigeons in much of the city. Of course, they outlawed feeding pigeons because they know that pigeons, being robots, don't actually eat. They just pretend to eat to cause us to think that they're fit. But that's a whole other thing. Anyhow, so you got the right wingers saying, you know, do you want the garbage collectors to be the meter maids of trash? Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, city could levy a fine of up to $500 for the first violation, $750 for the second, $1,000 for the third. I'll tell you, you know, where I live. We have a community garbage collection area, and it's recycled. You know, there's the spot for bottles, and there's a spot for flattened cardboard, and there's the spot for plastic, and there's a spot for paper, and for the stuff you just can't figure out, and it's probably going to end up in the landfill. And one of my neighbors, who I so admire this guy, and I found out about it by screwing up. If you put the wrong stuff in the wrong bag in the wrong bin, and it's got your name anywhere on it, he'll send you an email going, you screwed up here. You put this in the wrong. And, you know, so he jokingly refers to himself as the trash Nazi. But I think it's great. You know, Louise and I have gotten very fastidious about recycling because we were called on it when we first moved in, we really didn't know the system. But we got called on it by our neighbors, by our peers. And peer pressure is a really powerful thing. But when you've got a big city and you've got individual pickup at the curb, peer pressure doesn't necessarily work because, you know, people don't know each other. People don't talk to each other. So maybe $1,000 fine. I don't know. What do you think? Is this socialism over the top? Finally, I know we're all over the place. There's just a lot of stuff in the news, and we'll toss open the phone lines right after the break at the bottom of the hour and let you let you comment on this at 866-303-2270. Your thoughts on this. I think this is Ron Suskind. We're going to have him on the program here, certainly on Monday, possibly on Friday. But he's come right out now, said President Bush, Bob Considine, writing for MSNBC, President Bush committed an impeachable offense by ordering the CIA to manufacture a false pretense for the Iraq war in the form of a backdated, handwritten document linking Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. And Ron Suskind won the Pulitzer Prize. He's going to be on. He's going to be on the program Friday at 2 o'clock. Thank you, Louise. He won the Pulitzer Prize, and he says that this was a forged document. The CIA forged a document, and in fact, George Tenet came back to the CIA headquarters with the orders to do this on White House letterhead, and sat down with a couple of professional spooks. And well, this is how Suskind writes it. He says the White House had concocted a fake letter from Habush to Saddam, backdated it to July 1st, 2001. It said that 9/11 ringleader Mohammed Atta had actually trained for the mission in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. And CIA officers Ricker and John McGuire, who oversaw the Iraq operations group, are both on the record in the book confirming the existence of this fake letter. The CIA folks, Suskind writes, the CIA folks involved in the book and others talk about George Tenet coming back to the White House with the assignment on White House stationery and turning to the CIA operatives, who are professionals, and saying, you may not like this, but this is our next mission. And they carried it through step by step all the way to the finish. In other words, they forged a phony handwritten letter from an Al-Qaeda guy, from a real Al-Qaeda guy. It's a phony letter from a real Al-Qaeda guy to Saddam Hussein, making it look like Saddam and Al-Qaeda were communicating. The CIA forged this. The London Sunday Telegraph first published the letter, a story about the letter, in December of 2003. Keep in mind, that's a couple months before the invasion of Iraq. It was reported as genuine. It was reported as genuine. The letter made an immediate impact upon the media in terms of justifying the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Suskind relates how NBC reported the letter, with journalist Con Coughlin telling Tom Brokaw, the letter is really, quote, concrete proof that Al-Qaeda was working with Saddam, end of quote, on NBC News with Tom Brokaw. I mean, so they hatched this scheme. This George W. Bush hatched this scheme to lie to the American people. This, Suskind says, this is one of the greatest lies in American political history. It is a crime of greater impact than Watergate. Somebody call Nancy Pelosi and tell her, please. Ask her to read Ron Suskind's book. I don't know. Yeah, I know, the timing's bad. But the timing wasn't bad 2 years ago, or a year ago, or 3 years ago, or four. Anyway, don't get me started. Well, I guess you already did. 866-303-2270, our number, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call us at 866-303-2270.
Past the hour, and boy, some weird stuff out there. The heirs of the Knights Templar have launched a legal battle in Spain to force the Pope to restore the reputation of the disgraced order, which was accused of heresy and dissolved 7 centuries ago. Yes, the Knights Templar are suing Pope Benedict the 16th for 100 billion euros. That's $79 billion. Do not, under any circumstances, go to the website Knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S, Templar, T-E-M-P-L-A-R.com. because then you will discover who really runs the world. And, yeah, you don't want that happening. And, by the way, tip of the hat to my colleague and friend Randy Rhodes. She has won, and Air America as well, I guess they're co-litigants in this, has a federal appeals court says a radio talk show host's criticism of a U.S. government contractor, this from CNN's Money.com, at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq was protected by the First Amendment. A three-judge panel, the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on Tuesday, unanimously rejected Khaki International Inc.'s defamation lawsuit against the liberal talk radio network Air America and one of its hosts, Randy Rhodes. Khaki sued for $11 million after Rhodes accused company employees of raping and murdering Iraqi civilians at Abu Ghraib. A federal judge in Alexandria, Virginia, dismissed the lawsuit. The appeals court upheld that decision, saying Khaki failed to prove the statements were made with actual malice or reckless disregard for the truth. So, a tip of the hat to Randy and to the folks at Air America. And, yeah. So, you are opposed to recycling fees, David, in Los Angeles.
Actually, a good show. I'm a first-time caller, a first-time listener. And just want to let you know you have a good show.
Thank you.
I was telling your screener there that, yes, I am opposed to that.
So what are we going to do with all this trash? I mean, we've got mountains of trash, mountains of trash.
I tell you, just the other day I went and I recycled some plastic and some bottles that I had. You know what? If you pay people more money, I mean, I see a lot of guys pushing trash carts, you know, I mean, not trash carts, food carts. You know, they take them from the stores and they go around picking the bottles and cans.
Right.
You know what? If you pay more money for recycling, I mean, let me tell you, you're going to get rid of a lot of plastic bags. You're going to get rid of
But see, you're really, what you're doing is you're charging on the front end rather than paying on the back end. I mean, either way, consumers end up paying for it. I mean, I remember, you know, I grew up in Michigan and we were one of the first states to have a bottle bill and there was a huge battle. There was one of the big bottling companies was in Michigan where they made the bottles and they were just totally freaked out. What, you know, 5 cents for a bottle? And it was this huge screaming debate back in the 70s. And, you know, what happened? Suddenly there wasn't all that litter. I mean, you know, so I don't disagree that we should raise the fees. And, in fact, there are some cities, I think Seattle now is charging 20 cents for plastic bags. San Francisco has banned them. But at a certain point, we have to say enough already. We are trash, and thank you for the call, Dave. We are trashing the oceans. We are trashing the land. And perhaps even worse, all of this stuff that isn't being recycled are resources that were dug out of the ground somewhere. They were mined somewhere, downriver from them. Waters are polluted, downland from them. Land is polluted. Land is rendered unusable. On and on it goes. I mean, and recycling is like, you know, it's like found stuff. It's just, you just have to make the economics of it work. Should it be punitive or should it be economic? David says economic. I tend to agree with him. But I think the punitive really needs to be a piece of it, too. Ollie in Salem, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Ollie.
Hey, Tom, I think that we are Americans, and we can come up with a better way than to just say, let's just separate it at home, and that's it. The garbage goes to a landfill, the landfills keep growing, and we don't get any more jobs out of the deal. It just stays the same throughout time. So...
Yeah, well, so you do jobs. You know, when I lived in Vermont, we had the trash company that picked up our trash. Thanks, Ollie, for that. The trash company that picked up our trash, we didn't, you know, everything was just tossed into one. Even if you tried separating things, they tossed it into one giant truck. But the state required recycling. Turned out that what this company was doing was they were taking the trash down to Massachusetts, where they hired a bunch of folks. And, you know, I saw a photo of this once, and my guess is that they were hiring people who were not in the country legally, shall we say. But they hired a bunch of folks, paid them rather poorly, but paid them to, on an assembly line kind of thing, literally go through the trash and pull out the plastic, pull out the paper. And so they were recycling after the fact. Is that a way to do it? I mean, we paid a lot to have our trash hauled away, to have those people recycling through our stuff. I don't know. It's an interesting one. Obi, is it Obi or Abby in La Crosse? Abby. Hey, Abby in La Crosse, Wisconsin. What's up?
Hi, Tom. On recycling and disposal fees, I had this thought many years ago when trying to get rid of a tire. At the time, you had to pay $3 to get rid of a tire. Wouldn't it be, and that takes a disincentive from disposing the tire properly. People throw it in a ditch over
right,
a ravine
people hide them.
And so on. Instead, why not have a $3 tax on the tire when you buy it? And this should go to all products that have some sort of disposal cost. The cost of oil, batteries, and everything. Why not have the cost of disposal charged as a tax at the time the product is purchased? Then nobody has a disincentive from disposing the product properly. The disposal fee has already been paid for.
What if we reconfigure? See, the problem is it gets so complex. I mean, say there's some plastic in a package, you know, for you buy a cable for your iPod or something, and there's plastic in that package. How do you build the cost of that plastic to the point that when you recycle that plastic, it has value? Because, I mean, the system that you're proposing would be, let's take the bottle bill and make it huge. In other words, you're recycling. Wouldn't it be great if my trash company, instead of my paying the trash company to haul stuff away, the trash company paid me because I put stuff in the baskets. You know, they paid me because I put stuff in the glass in the bottle thing because it had value and they could recycle it. If I put metal in the metal thing because it had value and it could be recycled. Paper in the paper thing because it has value and it could be recycled. Or if they didn't pay it, but they just took it away for free, you know, in exchange for having something of value. And the way to do that, as you say, Abhi, is to build some sort of a fee on the front end, like with the bottle bill. But how do you do it for stuff that is, you know, that broad swath of products out there?
I don't know the direct answer to that, but one thought that brings up is we were visiting a friend in Germany some years ago, and he brought his example was, and I guess he says that they have to pay for by the pound for any trash that's not recycling. I think they referred to it as the yellow bag.
That's the punitive end of it, exactly. Yeah.
Right. And
everything else is taken away for free.
The result of that was a dramatic decrease in packaging. One example that he used was the liquid detergent that we get. We get these liquid detergents in these great big plastic gallon jugs. Instead, they sell the same detergent in powdered form in bulk. So instead of having all these plastic bottles clogging up the trash, you get the same detergent by getting a little thing of powder, and then you mix it with liquid at home, and
right.
You end up with the same product.
Yeah, or like in the health food store, you know, you go in and you want extra virgin olive oil, they've got it, you know, the 10-gallon jug, and you just bring your own bottle in and fill it from there. Or in all over Vermont, it used to be that way with maple syrup and things like that. Yeah, that's a great one, Abhi. Thank you very much. Let's see here, Rob in Earliesville, Virginia. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Tom. I live in Earliesville, but I used to live in Charlottesville, and they did just what you guys were talking about. They made you buy a green sticker to put on for 80 cents to put on a 32-gallon waste bucket. Mm-hmm. They would take it if it had the sticker on there, and their recycling was free. And so if you were a big waste generator and you were somebody who didn't recycle and you had five containers, you were paying 80 cents for each one of those containers. So surprisingly enough, around the university where I live, the University of Virginia, there were students that would have big parties and they'd throw all the stuff in the trash, and they actually had a trash cop who, if you didn't have the sticker on there, you got a citation. Mm-hmm. And but what it really did was it really made you try very, very hard to recycle, because if you could only put out one trash receptor one day or one week, day out of the week, that was 80 cents as opposed to it. And I thought the system worked very, very well under that, and they accepted massive things to recycle. It was a great deal.
Yeah, fascinating. Rob, thank you very much. I'll tell you know, because we live on the river, we have to walk up about a three-story or two, depending on how high the river is, because it goes up and down with the tides and with the rain, and it'll go, you know, it'll vary as much as 15 or 20 feet over the course of the year. But, you know, we have to climb this long ramp to get up there. So everything that comes down to our house, we have to physically carry back out. And it's about a city block down the dock and then up the ramp. And you really get in touch with your garbage when you have to carry literally every single piece that you bring in, you have to bring out. And Sean is nodding her head. She and Rod live on one of these weird contraptions as well. Parker in San Luis Obispo, and listening on KYNS. Hey, Parker.
Hey, I'd like to say you're the most optimistic man in America.
Thank you.
Yeah. My point about the recycling is that conservatives would probably be clamoring for a voucher if they did that stuff. And I think it's more important to be punitive, at least for a short term, so people can come face-to-face with their magnitude of garbage, you know, with their garbage stream. I think it would
be, or charge it on the front end. I mean, the one problem with the punitive is that there are going to be some folks who have so much money that they don't give a damn. And so, you know, are they going to disrupt the system? But you know, excellent point, Parker. Thank you very much. How do we do this? The bottom line is we have to do it. We got to do something about this because we literally are being buried in garbage. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman program.
Back to the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain, although it does not lead to stiff thinking. Robert in Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Robert.
How you doing today, Tom?
It's great. What's on your mind?
I just happened to turn my Cirrus radio on. I know you guys talking about recycling, and I just want to say, in the city of Hartford, Connecticut, we have a pilot program that's going throughout the city where residents get paid to put their garbage out. I put their recyclers out.
See, that's great. It's a positive incentive rather than a negative disincentive.
Yep, and it's been a real positive because the city in turn will get money back for the amount of recyclers that they recycle. So it's a good program. It's a wonderful program.
Yeah, where does the money come from, Robert? I mean, is the city actually making money selling the stuff that they recycle, or is this at some level subsidized by taxes?
It's a private entity that is doing it right now because they're trying to get it across the entire United States. But the pilot program is actually started here in Hartford, Connecticut.
Interesting. So they're making their money actually off the value of the trash.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the way it is right now, all the recyclers is going one container. There's no sorting. So it just goes, it's like before you used to have to sort the bottles and,
right.
So you don't have to do that. Everything is in one container. They come in to dump it, and it goes to the plant.
So it's just like we had in Vermont, where they somehow sort it out themselves, some of it manually, some of it by machine.
Yep.
Yeah, interesting. Robert, thank you very much for the report. I appreciate it. Doug in Huntington Woods, Michigan. Hey, Doug.
Hey, actually, I guess my report's almost a repetition of what I just heard. In Huntington Woods, we aren't paid to put the recyclables out. But we have been told that the city actually makes money off of the recyclables. We do separate newspaper from plastic and metal, but for the most part, everything goes in one can.
Yeah.
And, they told us if you see people picking up the recyclables, stop them, you know, if it's not the city trucks, whatever, because we make money off that. So
yeah.
There's
That's
real progress
great.
On
That's
it.
That's great. So, and there's the peer pressure, you know, like, you know, our friend, our neighbor. But now here you've got the entire city saying,
speaking
hey, help us out, you know, it's community.
Speaking of peer pressure, I think Huntington Woods should challenge other cities in Michigan because we lead in the percentage of trash recycled. So if any city wants to try and take our title, they're going to have to work hard.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Doug. I appreciate the call. Ian in Charlottesville, Virginia, listening to WVAX. Hey, Ian.
Hey, Tom. How about we cut down on all the packaging for all these products we buy in a grocery store?
Yeah, great idea.
We got, you know, plastic and cardboard that just gets thrown in the recycler. You know, why not use some sort of innovative product to package these things?
Well, here's a straightforward way to do that, and that is to put a tax on packaging. Right? I mean, there is an actual packaging industry out there. There are trade publications. They have annual conventions. There are packaging engineers. There's, you know, it's studied. But, you know, so there would be an interest group that would be opposed to it. But if you simply said, if it is product, then there's no tax. It's sort of like a value-added tax like they have in Europe, you know. But if it's packaging, then there's a 3% tax, for example, on it. And then the money from that tax goes to municipalities, to cities, to communities, counties, whatever, for recycling programs.
Does this start at a statewide level? Or
maybe you could do it federally. I don't know. But I think it would actually have to be done federally because you know, so much of the packaging is actually made in China. I mean, you can't walk into a Walmart and find anything made in the U.S., and all that packaging was made in China, too. So you would have to include that in some sort of a tariff. It could get complex, but you have to figure out how to make it work. Let me ponder that one. Ian, thanks a lot for the call and for the heads up. David in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. What's up?
I happen to live in a community just outside the city of Birmingham, and there is no. I was very surprised. I moved here from North Carolina, and was very surprised to find that there is no recycling available in my community.
None. It's not even an option.
I beg your pardon?
It's not even an option. They just have a giant landfill someplace, and that's where everything goes.
There's not even an option, and we've looked all over the city for places where we can take our glass, you know, and take our cans and things for recycling, and have been unable to find any place.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, David. You need to let the burghers of Birmingham or your community there know about the experience in Huntington Beach, Michigan, or Huntington, whatever it was, Michigan. David, thanks a lot for the call. Nancy in Pasadena. Hey, Nancy.
I think your show should be mandatory listening.
Thank you.
For where we are, we're in Los Angeles County. We are running out of landfill space big time. Bring on the garbage Nazi. I went from a can a week to a paper grocery bag a month of trash that I throw out. And where my brother lives in Newport Beach, they have a different program. They don't sort anything. The city does it for you. But the law is nobody can take any soda cans or anything out of the trash cans on the beaches, and that pays for it.
Hmm.
They also take the soda cans out of people's own trash.
Right. So once again, you have a situation where the intrinsic value of the trash is being recovered.
Absolutely.
That the city is getting that money back out of the stuff that's in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing.
Yeah, it's thank you, Nancy. It's appreciate the call. I mean, this we've got to look at this stuff. I mean, it's
who wants to talk about trash? Well,
it is a major problem. We are producing mind-boggling amounts. Actually, we produce between 25% and 35% of the world's trash. The United States does. And if you include manufacturing processes overseas, particularly in China, for consumption in the United States, it goes above 35%, which is really amazing. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our second hour. Our quote for the day, by the way, by the Marquis de Lafayette, an old and dear friend of Thomas Jefferson's, who wrote, "When the government violates the people's rights, insurrection is, for the people and for each portion of the people, the most sacred of the rights and the most indispensable of duties." The Marquis de Lafayette. Terry Jeffrey is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of CNSnews.com. And, Terry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom.
Last week, we were talking about the Constitution. And you were making the point that all of this government spending is not only socialist, but it's unconstitutional. You recall?
Mm-hmm.
And you want to make that point again, because I have my rebuttal for you.
Okay. Yeah, my point is that Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution actually spells out what the Congress of the United States can spend money doing. And if you can't justify it by Article 1, Section 8, then in my view, then Congress can't spend the money.
Okay, and then you can also go on to Section 9, which says what Congress can't do, and it doesn't say anywhere there that Congress can't spend the money under powers forbidden to Congress. But let's skip B, you kind of blew off my suggestion that the preamble of the Constitution actually defines the powers of everybody and everything, and it says that, you know, the general welfare is one of the things that they established the Constitution for. But here's where it gets real specific. Go to Article 2, where the powers of the presidency are established.
Right.
And in Article 2, Section 2, they're talking about that the president has the power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. He shall nominate the advice and consent of the Senate, appoint ambassadors, other public ministers, and all other officers of the United States,
right,
whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. So first of all, established by law. In other words, Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, can establish branches of government, as it were,
right,
and the president can determine who the heads of those branches are. And then it continues. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. In other words, Congress can create these agencies. Congress can vest in the president or in the courts or even in the agencies themselves the power to operate these agencies, and they can do anything they damn well please. It's right there, Article 2, Section 2.
They can't do anything they please. They can create.
They can do anything that's not specifically forbidden by the Constitution.
My rebuttal to what you say is that they can create agencies of the federal government in order to carry out the functions of the government that Article 1, Section 8 gives them the power to fight.
No, Article 1, Section 8 does not define the functions of government. It defines specific things that Congress
must do, and
Section 9 defines things Congress may not do.
It says quite literally, Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, and
right, these are the things that they must do, or that, you know, that they have the specific power to do. But the preamble, here's where the purpose of it, you know, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. That's where it states the purpose of Congress.
If, in fact, the Constitution was written simply to tell the Congress that it could create programs and spend money on anything it thinks aided the general welfare of the American people, then there's no reason for the rest of the Constitution. We do not have a limited government. And I would just advocate anybody in your audience that's interested to go back and read the debates of the Constitutional Convention and read what the framers of the convention believed and read how they acted when they were actually in office, including Thomas Jefferson, who had an extremely limited view of the federal government and believed that the actions of each branch of the federal government were severely circumscribed by exactly what the Constitution said those branches of the government should do.
And yet in the George Washington administration, Thomas Jefferson administration, in the John Adams administration,
that's right,
the federal government was writing checks to pay for to pay for housing and food for indigent people. And in fact, it was James Madison who put an end to it. And he only sort of left-handedly put an end to it because they had been doing it through churches.
What are you talking about, people on Indian reservations?
No, I'm talking about people in Washington, D.C. James Madison said that it was his first veto. Go back and read his first veto message. He said that this is establishing a terrible precedent. Obviously, his language was more archaic than this. That giving money to churches would corrupt the churches, and therefore the money should be written directly out of the treasury.
Thomas Jefferson actually built the Catholic Church on an Indian reservation. But let me ask you something. I don't know this precise history of what you're talking about, but you say in Washington, D.C. Did they do this in the states?
No.
Okay. Now, the Constitution also says that the Congress of the United States shall have total jurisdiction for the District of Columbia. So, in other words,
right,
Congress...
It was their responsibility.
Let me complete my thought, David. The Constitution gives Congress authority over the District of Columbia in the same sense that the government of the state of Virginia has authority over the state of Virginia. So, yes, Congress is responsible for welfare programs in the District of Columbia because, in fact, it is equivalent to the state or municipal government of the District of Columbia.
No, Terry, you and I agree on the history of this. I'm not disputing that, and I'm not disputing that in the early days of the Republic, pre-Lincoln, basically, because Lincoln flipped us from a weak federal government with strong states to a strong federal government with weak states as a result of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and the end of the Civil War. And we've had a dramatic change in the power of federal government ever since then. But the issue is, or the problem, I guess, is that if we were to go back to the pre-Abraham Lincoln weak federal government, strong state government model, then you and simply say, okay, it's up to the states. Then you would have poor states that where if you just happened to be born in that state, you'd get a lousy education. You wouldn't have any opportunity for Social Security for in your old age. I mean, these were the issues that Roosevelt was looking at in the 1930s as the Republican Great Depression was just devastating America. And you had a lot of poor states that had they didn't have the money to do the things that needed to be done.
Well, let me add one thing into your historical timeline there. In fact, the Federalists in the early administrations of our government, George Washington, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, they believed they were advocating a strong central government. For those things that the Constitution, in fact, advocated the central government have power. And the Jeffersonians, the Republicans, as they were then believed in states' rights and a weak central government, for those things that the Constitution actually gave to the federal government. The difference, I believe, Tom, is, and I do believe that Lincoln did, in fact, effect a difference. But here's where I think Lincoln and Roosevelt differed on increasing the power of the central government. What Lincoln had to deal with a great evil, which was the evil of slavery. And, he tried to do everything he could short of going to war to deal with it. And even in war, he tried to do everything he can to moderate what he did to increase the power of the federal government. In the end, after Lincoln was assassinated, we had to have the 13th and 14th Amendments to outlaw slavery and to give the federal government the authority to enforce equal protection of the law, particularly in the former slave states, so that African Americans' rights were protected. That was a necessary increase of the federal government in order to protect the basic constitutional rights of the American people. It wasn't in order to create a welfare state, which is what Roosevelt did in the 1930s.
Well, my point is that the Constitution, that the founders and framers of this country, Jefferson himself talked about how, every generation, every 19 years, we should reinvent this country. That the framers very much believed that the Constitution was a living document, that the interpretation of it, that our perception of ourselves as a state, as a nation state, over time, should change. It should change with the times. And here we are. We've changed with the times. We have looked at laissez-faire capitalism and weak federal systems and seen that what they produce is essentially feudalism. And we have looked at what you would call a socialist state, and actually what the Finns and the Danes call socialist states, democratic socialism. Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist. We have looked at socialism and said, we think we're going to try that. We like the socialist police departments and the socialist fire departments and the socialist public schools and the socialist social security program and the socialist Medicare program. Seems to work pretty good.
Okay, well, just one other thing I'd add to that, though, is when Lincoln, it wasn't Lincoln, actually, it was under his Andrew Johnson, his successor, and Ulysses S. Grant in the Republican Congresses at that time, they actually amended the Constitution to make the changes they did. The 14th Amendment was a legitimate amendment to the Constitution to protect the rights of African Americans in the former slave states, and for that matter, all throughout the Union. Starting to create a welfare state in the 1930s, FDR did not amend the Constitution.
He didn't have to.
He did think, even Daniel Patrick Moynihan thought the Social Security program was extra constitutional. I don't believe we're going to eliminate Social Security. It is not something the Constitution authorized the federal government.
Okay, well, let's take this conversation, Terry, to the next level and put it in the context of Barack Obama and John McCain right after the break, okay? Stick around. Terry Jeffrey, he's the editor-in-chief of CNSnews.com, the website. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Danger. the hardest thing.
It's the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman program. Welcome back. Terry Jeffrey with us. He's the editor-in-chief over at CNSNews.com. And Terry, you know, I know that you think Barack Obama is a socialist and that Medicare and Social Security are, to quote you on CNN recently when you were talking with Wolf Blitzer, you said that Medicare and Social Security are flat-out socialism. And you know, we've already kind of debated that, I guess, if you want to use that term. I have no problem with it. But here's the thing that baffles me, and because I think we're both kind of pro-business guys, although in very different ways. Starbucks is shutting down Starbucks shops all over the United States. And it turns out that the main reason is that when this company grew its workforce up to 172,000 people, all of its employees, even part-time employees, were given health insurance. And it's costing them $200 million a year for its 80,000 U.S. employees, more than the total it's spending on coffee from Africa, Indonesia, and other countries. And if we had, like Canada does, I mean, Toyota looked at this. This was like 6-8 years ago. They were going to build a car factory in the U.S., and Alabama was trying to outcompete them. You know, I mean, actually, there were three different states. It looked like it was going to go to Alabama. They were giving them $300 million in tax breaks and free land and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And they, at the last minute, decided to build the plant outside of Montreal instead, or outside of Toronto instead. Why? Because Canada has free health care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the socialist health care program, a single-payer health care program, would, you know, whether you want to call it socialism or not, I mean, and see, I don't think it would be socialist because the government doesn't actually own the, you know, the hospitals and pay the doctor's salaries. But nonetheless, socialism is good for business.
Yeah, well, it can be designed to be a partnership between business and government, and I think that's what it oftentimes is. I think that's what's going on between the health insurance companies and the federal government when you talk about Medicare. You have essentially what I believe, as you said, is a socialist program. And who benefits the most from those socialist programs? The executives of these health insurance companies who are making millions of dollars a year.
I know. I agree. I think it's a disaster. And that's because your Republican comrades wanted to privatize as much as possible, you know, what should have been a program that had no piece of privatization to it, and bring for-profit corporations into an industry that should have no profit motive.
Well, I think one of the problems there is, and we talked about this before, is the third-party payer. The fact is, maybe we'll talk about my interview with Congressman Ryan, but he at least pinpoints one problem, which is that healthcare in the United States of America isn't a relationship between a doctor and a patient. It's a relationship between your employer and a healthcare company. Unless you happen to be rich enough to buy your own insurance or have your own small business or whatever, if you're working for somebody, chances are your employer, if it's Starbucks, they're buying the health insurance from some other big company. And both those companies are trying to maximize their profits so that the executive's pay is increased the most. And the government is providing tax subsidies and payments to those groups, those big businesses. They're not providing it to you.
Right, and we get screwed. So
that's right.
In your conversation with Congressman Ryan, which people can read over at CNSNews.com, you know, he's basically saying that the United States is going bankrupt, and you are as well, as a result of entitlements, specifically Social Security and Medicare or Medicaid. Why don't we just lift the cap on Social Security and have a similar tax on for Medicare and do away with private for-profit health insurance companies and hospitals? Say you can be a not-for-profit corporation. We want separate corporations. We don't want the government owning these things. And do it like a single-payer program.
Well, the point that Congressman Ryan made in my interview with him, and he had it scored by the Congressional Budget Office, which is a different organization than the GAO, which David Walker used to run.
Okay.
They came back and they told him, if you're going to raise taxes up so that 25 years from now we can cover the cost of Medicare and Social Security, you're talking about the lowest tax rate being 25%, and the tax rate for middle-class people, we're talking about people making about $70,000 a year, they're going to pay 66%, and wealthier people are going to pay about an 88% income tax. David Walker, that's what the CBO told Congressman Ryan when they scored his plan. David Walker has said we're talking about 40% of GDP being swallowed up by the government. Right now it swallows up about 20%. So we're talking about twice the share of the national wealth going to the federal government as now goes there. And somehow, Tom, they're going to have to tax that money out of America. So you're talking about a massive tax increase on the American people.
Right, and yes and no. I mean, last week you said you were talking about how the average person, the average wage earner in the United States is paying 30 or 40% in their taxes. Actually, a family of four with two kids and two deductions making $50,000 a year, and the median in the United States, $44,000, is paying 6% income tax right now, federal
right.
income tax.
Right, well, what,
so, you know. These numbers are not quite adding
well,
up, Terry.
The figure I cited and the source for it, and people don't have to believe me. They can just go to the Tax Foundation and look at their report. But the Tax Foundation calculated is if you take the total national income and then you take the total revenue that the government is taking in, the revenue the government is taking is 30.8% of the total national income. But now, how that is distributed from person to person.
Well, it's because we're running an empire all over the world.
Well, that's part of it.
It really is. I mean, you know, our medical spending and our Social Security are a fraction of the cost of our Pentagon.
But, Tom, look, I probably share your... I'm not in favor of an interventionist foreign policy. I'm not a Wilsonian. I believe in a realistic foreign policy for the United States. And, you know, I disagree with both John McCain and Barack Obama on their foreign policy.
Okay. But always an interesting conversation, Terry. Thanks for dropping by.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Terry Jeffrey, CNSNews.com is his website. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your radio support group for We the People.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Spanish, Hindi, and Dolphin, just so I could relate. I'm exhausted from taxing and spending and controlling the media and hiding my agenda and ruling San Francisco as a separatist nation state. And in yoga today, I got bent out of shape because the guy doing bowl pulling O's next to me was intolerant, which I hate. Budget and needing approval and reading the nation and leading a sing-along. Everybody! No, wait, that was just an impulse. Sorry. Oh, I shoot the hoops with some brothers when I sprain my badonkadonk. And you know that ain't chill. Saved an endangered snail darter from being eaten by an endangered spotted owl, which I saved from being eaten by an endangered snow leopard, which I saved from being shot by a vulture, who I had to kill. With kindness.
Kindness. 36 minutes past the hour, taking back the mainstream media, the Tom Hartman Radio Program here, and our Higgins alert for the day. Yes, well, it actually starts out with an English bulldog by the name of Napoleon. English bulldogs are pretty notoriously bad swimmers, but this one, with his master walking along the oceans or the lakeside in Michigan, and saw a sack in the lake, jumped into the water, dragged it to the shore, and inside were six kittens, two of them already dead. Somebody had tossed them in and tried to get rid of them, so Napoleon, six kittens in total. Napoleon's mom cared for the survivors for the 2 weeks until they could be taken to the city pet adoption center and found new homes. Napoleon got a much-deserved hero's welcome at the adoption center as crowds gathered to praise the brave bulldog and cuddle the rescued kittens. This is from BulldogGabby.com. Also, did you know that if you yawn around a dog, The odds are 72% that the dog will catch your yawn. So far, they've only known that this is true of people and primates. I'm Tony Higgins. If yawns around me, and it makes me yawn. So I've never actually paid attention about whether I make him yawn or not. I need to check that out. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ed in Kansas. Hey, hey Ed, what's up?
Hey, that fellow you just had on.
Terry Jeffrey.
Yeah, every time he's on, he does the same thing. He misreads Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 tells us that the Congress can tax us to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. And then he thinks that the next 17 clauses in Section 8, because there's 18 clauses, he thinks that those are all subordinate to Clause 1, but they are not. They are separate clauses, and they are separate powers that the Congress has.
Oh, that's an excellent perspective. And let me just take a look here. Article 1, Section 7.
Article 1, Section 8.
Section 8. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes.
And remember,
duties.
It doesn't say Congress shall have the power. It says Congress shall have power to lay
right.
and collect taxes, to borrow, to regulate, to establish.
Right. Yeah.
That is the correct English reading of this, particularly if you go back to literature of the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it ends with a semicolon, but
each of them end with semicolons. The only one that has an intervening semicolon is where it says, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States, which
right.
was overturned when we passed the income tax.
Right. Interesting. Ed, you are brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You are too, my friend.
Thank you. I love talking about the Constitution. I appreciate it. Thank you, Ed. 866-303-2270. Kim in Seattle. Hey, Kim.
Hello. I don't have anything quite so erudite to say, but you mentioned how the federal government provided for indigent populations. And I think you must have been wanting not to embarrass Mr. Jeffers, because you said you kind of glossed over that. But then you started talking about Indian reservations. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Tom didn't mention anything about Indian reservations. So I think he misread what indigent means.
Well, no, actually, he's not here and can't speak for himself, but I'm pretty confident about where he was going with that. His point was that the Constitution gives Congress the specific authority, and it's right there in the Constitution. It's the not just the authority, the obligation to take care of people who live in Washington, D.C., and on the Indian reservations. I mean, it says and on Indian reservations in the
Constitution. Oh, I guess I thought he was confusing the word indigent with Indian or something.
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm guessing that was pretty much the case.
I have one more thing to say to you,
sure.
If I can.
Yeah, in fact, here's the phrase: to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and the Indian tribes, for example.
Got it.
Yeah.
And I have one more thing to say to you. I don't know if you could have your radio show on at the same time, but I think you should be a marketing consultant or a political consultant to Barack Obama and help him, you know, develop his buzz phrases.
Yeah, I'd love it. I'd love it. But I'm pretty busy these days. But that's why I wrote the book Cracking the Code. And my hope was that, you know, the Obama campaign and every Democrat out there would read the thing, because it's just, you know, here's how you do it. Kim, I have to move along. Thank you for the call, and thank you for your kind words. Mike in San Francisco. Hey, Mike.
Oh, sorry about that. Got to turn off my radio here.
Okay. What's up?
I just was curious why we need to start moving the conversation towards health insurance for all and questioning conservatives, why they always refer to it as getting more people insured as opposed to getting all people insured.
Right, and also, why are they so anti-business? Why do they think that it's a fine thing that Starbucks is going out of business because they can't, or not out of business, they're closing all these stores because they can't afford health insurance for everybody? Why is it a fine thing that Toyota moved their factory to Canada instead of the U.S. because they didn't want to have to pay for health insurance? Why are conservatives who think that national health care is socialism, why are they so anti-business? Because the best thing, you want to make American businesses competitive in the worldwide stage, do the same thing that every other fully developed nation around the world has done. Excellent point, Mike. Thank you very much for that. Scotty in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Scotty, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I love your show.
Thanks.
I have a kind of an interesting question. I'm wondering if you could draw parallels to the SNL crisis of Bush 1 to
right.
what's going on now with this economic fiasco and just
yes,
kind
you
of
could. See. They're both the consequence of intentional and specific deregulation that allowed a small number of people to get very wealthy, and involved corrupting Congress. Remember the Keating Five, as in John McCain.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So there's a direct line. There's a direct parallel. I don't. You know, your point though, the larger point, somebody should put together a spreadsheet or a side by side comparison, of the history and the timelines of them. Maybe somebody already has, and if so, I'm guessing probably somebody in the chat room will let me know, or somebody will send me an email about it. But I don't have that at the tip of my fingertips. But I do know that the whole Keating Five thing, there was legislation, John McCain and others, the corruption was deregulation. It was the same thing as the Enron loophole, Ken Lay, in 2000. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. These guys get their fingers in there. They say, oh, it's got to be the free market. It's got to be laissez-faire capitalism. That's the only thing that works. And then as soon as it happens, as soon as they get it, then they use it to rob, the rest of us. It's pillaging. So, Scotty, I got to move along, but good one. Mark in Las Vegas. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, yes. I was originally going to ask a question about Terrence Jeffries' background, but I went up on CNS News and found out that his bachelor's degree was in English literature. It would be really nice if you're going to have a discussion about the Constitution, if you could have a third guest on, an actual constitutional scholar?
To his credit, at least Terry has a bachelor's degree, can't claim.
But it's also interesting to note that in 84 and 85, he studied Arabic at the Arabic Language Institute for the American.
No, I think that's a marvelous thing. If somebody, Mark, thanks for the call. And yes, we do have constitutional scholars on from time to time. Marjorie Cohn is one of my absolute favorites. And, if there's a fine point about the Constitution, but I think that there's a lot to be said for the ability of all of us as Americans to figure this stuff out ourselves. And I'll just, I guess, leave it at that. Carl in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Carl, got a minute before the break. What's up?
Okay, I'll make it quick. I'd like to just, I worked 42 years, paid Social Security and Medicare all that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the word entitlement drives me out of my mind.
Yeah, good point.
And to hear this guy, Terry, talk as if we were on friggin' welfare drives me nuts. It's not my fault the government and the Congress keep stealing all the money so it can't compound with interest the way it should.
Yeah.
It
actually is compounding with interest because when Reagan started borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund in 83, or perhaps it was 84, they started the process in 83, the way that they did it is they bought bonds, and those bonds are paying 3-4, in some cases 5% interest, and so there is interest being accrued into the Social Security Trust Fund. The question is, how are we going to pay the bonds back? But Carl, your point is about the use of language is a very good one. Our choice: do we either come up with a different word to describe it? And I would say insurance is a good word. In fact, that's what it was originally called, was the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Program or something like that. Or do we rehabilitate entitlement?
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Before the hour, fighting for the common man and the common good. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ellen Ratner on the line with us for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, today Sherrod Brown, senator from Ohio, had a conference call with those of us reporters and was talking about a Cleveland, Ohio article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer that DHL had been bought by the Deutsche Post. And essentially from there, this had all been arranged by Rick Davis, who, as you know, works very closely with John McCain when he had his lobbying firm. Well, they had 8,200 jobs in Southwest Ohio, and all of a sudden they're going to go. And the Cleveland Plain Dealer did the research and found that, you know, here was Rick Davis. Here was John McCain, and there had actually also been some talk about passing legislation in terms of allowing this company to buy an American company.
Right.
Well, what they're saying is even the White House has been cooperative with them, and although a lobbyist can't necessarily do anything, John McCain and Rick Davis have done nothing.
Yeah, and I'm going to get into a good rant on this in the next hour because we're seeing America being sold out. Even when a foreign company comes in and so-called rescues, what is the Republicans love to refer to as insourcing, foreign company comes in, buys up a U.S. company and keeps it going, where are the profits going? They're going out of the United States. It's like, you know, there's no benefit to us. It's like either we're losing the jobs or they're being outsourced or whatever. By the way, Ellen, got an email from...
I saw that. Yes.
Oh, good.
Talk about... Yeah. We're you can reach us in China.
That's right. Yeah, for our listeners who are curious, talkradionews.com and tomhartman.com have not been blocked by the Chinese government, so we must be doing something wrong, Ellen. I don't think we've been talking about Darfur and China's role in it enough.
Right.
Unless you...
Well, maybe we should have it more on our website.
On our homepage, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Or maybe they just haven't figured it out yet. You know, they've got so many other websites to block. It's you know, it's a tough job being a dictator, communist dictator. So.
I guess so. Well, now, also, speaking of that, Nancy Pelosi released a statement just a few minutes ago saying that she wants the U.S. government to lean very heavily on the Chinese government because the Chinese have decided to bar Joey Cheek from attending the Olympics because of his advocacy for Darfur.
Right.
And they considered, and so now, Nancy Pelosi is calling on Bush to secure the entry of Joey Cheek.
You think he'll do it?
I just think, you know, it's kind of like the United Nations. We don't have a right if a leader of a foreign government, including Fidel Castro, chooses to come to speak at the United Nations. We can't stop them. This is like an international thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting. And the thing, you know, the thing that blows my mind, Ellen, is that the conservatives who were hysterical 30, 40 years ago about, or who are still hysterical about Cuba, for example, it's a communist dictatorship. We can't trade with a communist dictatorship. They have no problem trading with China, where, you know, they if you want to buy a liver, they'll find a political prisoner who matches your blood type, take him out and execute him.
Right.
I mean, their
human rights record is just abhorrent.
Oh, when I was in Dharamsala, we spent a week with the Dalai Lama and this little town in up in the Himalaya Mountains, just, you know, on the Indian side over the ridge from Tibet. And when I was there, this was 6 years ago, this is the one that was just made into a movie with Harrison Ford, Dalai Lama Renaissance. Every day that I was there, there would be 2, 3, 5, 6 people who would arrive making that long trek over the mountains coming. And in every case, or virtually every case, they started out a larger group than when they got there. They were either killed by soldiers, they were eaten by bears, they froze to death, they starved, they fell from the ledges. There were people fleeing Tibet, 1 million people murdered in Tibet by the Chinese, and people fleeing there to get to Dharamsala, which is it means a place of refuge, and where His Holiness lives. And one guy that I talked to, his brother had been executed because he was wearing a T-shirt. He was Tibetan. He was wearing a T-shirt with a picture of John Lennon on it. And the Chinese army that was occupying, I think it was Lhasa, Tibet, thought that the John Lennon was actually the Dalai Lama. And so they shot him on the street.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, it's interesting. I just remember Joey Cheek has been a guest of ours at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Interesting.
So, actually, I have a picture of myself with Joey sitting next to him.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, good people being not allowed into China. Ridiculous. Yeah. Also, six military officers convicted Hamdan today. They actually convicted him of the first war crimes tribunal, and they cleared him on three charges, supporting terrorism, two on conspiracy, but they convicted him on five counts. Just like in a quick trial that may be held in China or Russia, they're having the sentencing hearing today.
Jeez. Well, not only are we embracing China economically, but we're adopting their political system, it seems, at least down in Guantanamo.
It really is, and we certainly used the handbook that was used during World War II.
I wonder if we should start a lobbying effort to say, okay, the organs of the guys down in Guantanamo, if we're gonna execute them, let's make sure that we can sell their organs. Just if we're gonna be like the Chinese, let's just do it all the way. I'm sorry, I'm being very, very sorry.
Yes, you are being whatever.
Facetious. So what else is
there? Well, one last thing. Mrs. Bush has actually been very involved in the Burma-Myanmar. Today there was a briefing on the plane on the way from South Korea. There, she's going to be on the border to the refugee camps, never mentioned the word Myanmar. It's always Burma, Burma, Burma.
That's good, you know, good on her. Do you think
yeah.
that there's any truth to the National Enquirer reports that Laura and George are on the outs?
That's a longer discussion.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen. Lionel, coming up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to Tom Hartman.
Well, I'll just own up to it right up front. Lionel says, my colleague at Air America Radio, everyone's crazy except you and me, and I'm not so sure about you. Lionel, welcome to the show.
Tom, thank you. I'm honored.
Here's our in your honor. Yeah, maybe we both are, Lionel. What do you think?
Well, I never said I was, but I do feel, and I wish I knew Tom, somebody who said this, but they felt like they were diagonally parked on a parallel universe, and I wish I thought of it.
That's a great one. That's a great one.
But I didn't. And anyway, what this book is, and again, thank you very much. I'm a huge fan. Your show is nonpareil, and I mean that in the best way.
Well, thank you. And vice versa. You for many years have been doing excellent talk radio. And we're talking about Lionel's book, by the way. His brand new book just came out. Everyone's crazy except you and me, and I'm not so sure about you. And you were going to.
But by the way, you know, the other day I went into this. I'm sorry, this is shameless, but I went into a Barnes and Noble that I just wanted to see. You know, because they said it's coming out, and I, you know, it hits the book stands, and you've got, you know, 9,000 books in Sanskrit, nonetheless. So I can't even compare to you. So I did my first virgin, you know, go in there, and
right.
they have the book under humor. And I thought, okay, you know, yeah, it is. But no. I see it very serious. It's not funny.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the stuff in here. You know, you and I both got wood-burning kits when we were kids.
Well, you know,
how do we turn this? Is like a this is a political statement in some ways.
Well, also, I mean, there was some anecdotal things because everybody has something that you go through, you know, because I frankly learned a lot through professional wrestling, and I wish that we went back to, you know, this age where, you know, we were maybe less safe but more self-confident. But you said something in the last segment, and one of the things which I agree with, and you're also talking to our friend Ellen Ratner and about what's going on in the world, and what I talk about. One of my main passions is, and you mentioned this, and I talk about it in the book, is the Constitution, specifically First Amendment.
Right. You are, and, by the way, for our listeners, I should mention, you're an attorney, a former defense attorney, criminal defense attorney, and a former prosecuting attorney. So you have
indeed.
Some familiarity with this document.
And if there was one thing that was the most important to us, I think it's the first. And something happened recently, and people will do this. You mentioned it. Everybody carries around a copy of the Constitution, and that's great in terms of, you know, how old you have to be, 35, to be president. You know, Bill Clinton said, I'm not endorsing anybody. Just look at the Constitution to see what minimum requirements you need. But something happened recently, which is terrific, and this is what I think your audience should know, and I try to explain. There are people who believe the so-called Federalists, the Scalia, originalists, strict constructionists. They have all of these terms for using the Constitution whenever they want. I'm not sure if it's pari passu. I'm not sure what the term is. But something happened that was fantastic. The Second Amendment case, Heller, that came out, you know, the final case, does the Second Amendment mean that we have the right to individually possess a firearm, meaning that a city or a state or a community cannot ban the possession, or is it somehow connected to this antediluvian, anachronistic, you know, militia thing?
Right.
Scalia, who has for years railed against this nonsense of judicial legislation, reading into, he hated Harry Blackmun and coming up with privacy for Roe, and what are you talking about?
Right.
He came up with something where he said, I'm creating this absolute right to possess a firearm. And Stevens, usually the liberal, the judicial legislator, said, no, I'm a strict constructionist. Now, everybody listening, wake up. I know I just put you right to sleep. Mm. This goes to show you the hilarity. To me, it's absurd. It's funny. It is nonsense about the most important thing in the world that we have in this country. I'm sorry, the right to say, you know, what we think, how it's being played about with people who, frankly, scared the bejesus out of me, whatever a bejesus is.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Both of them.
Well, indeed.
Yeah. So we're talking with Lionel, his new book, Everyone's Crazy Except You and Me, and I'm Not So Sure About You. And you know, you do a great job in the book of skewering all forms of hypocrisy, particularly men who wear socks with sandals.
That also, and the first chapter is called I Hate Conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to get right to the bottom of this. I didn't want to fool around. Mm-hmm. I have never met, Tom, anybody who truly is what they purport to be. These, whenever you hear somebody use the term, I'm a conservative, I go right through the list, they don't know what they're talking about. They might have, I think they meant rock-ribbed, all-American, good guy, God-fearing, family-loving, cross-adoring, flag-wave, you know, whatever. And these are the biggest phonies who have ever walked this planet, and you can go down the list, pick your favorite, and the real, and how the neocons have been kind of blended into this mix.
And we can find the same thing on the left. I mean, here we have Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, who are so incapable of doing political theater that you've got, even after Congress has been closed, the door has been closed, you've got the Republicans doing political theater and getting the entire country going, hey, look at that, the Democrats won't even let us vote on energy. And Harry and Nancy are standing around going, oh, what? Political theater? Never heard of that. What's that?
Well, you know, the problem that I have is that we have, in fact, we have for the longest time, have been so angry at Bush and his, actually Cheney and his vice president Bush,
right,
that people have been screaming about, you know, impeachment, censure, anything, an asterisk. We've become Major League Baseball. Give him an asterisk. Take the title. And what I try to do is that people sometimes in their anger really fail to address kind of the historical precedents and the like. But also, there's some other things which may be some sacred cows which I try to address in this book, and that is hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most constitutionally awful things ever, Son of Sam laws. Now, when you also think, well, you know, isn't that good? No. Have you ever watched Predator? Or To Catch a Predator, Chris Hansen?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't believe you've ever really watched that. A man of your mental acumen.
It comes on after Keith Olbermann. You can't miss it.
Well, yeah, well, you can. It's true. Do you realize that we are...
Can't get to the TV fast enough to turn it off, but... Anyway, yeah.
Do you know that we have arrested people for thinking that they have committed a crime?
Yeah, no, back when you and I were youngins, it was called entrapment. And cases routinely got tossed out on that. But with regard to hate crimes, what about terrorism? I mean, if somebody is killing somebody or harming somebody with the intent not to harm that person,
right,
but to terrorize an entire community associated with that person, shouldn't there be an additional penalty for that?
One of the things that you need to do is that what you're doing is you can hate Aleuts. You can.
I'm talking about intent. It's like the difference between first and second degree murder.
Right, but if your intent was to say, listen, I'm going to, I don't want to just burn a cross, but I want to freak people out. Now, what I suggest in the book is, when it comes time for sentencing, you always take into account the particular effect this crime had on either a person, a family, a neighborhood, a community. The effect it had.
Yeah, but here's the problem. When it comes to sentencing in some little town in Alabama for that cross burning, they're going to say, yeah, hey, it terrorized a whole lot of black people here. Fine thing. Two days in jail.
Now, what happens is...
That's why you have hate crimes.
Well, the federal laws have the federal statutes have civil rights laws, which basically go to that. The idea, though, that you're going to allow judicial, relativity, you know, that a judge is going to be able to say, well, I don't think that's unfortunately one of the problems that we have. But what we are doing is, very simply, and this is tough for some people, is that we, in our reaction to something, want to pass laws, and we want to try to harness crazy human behavior, which sometimes, unfortunately, cannot be done, as evidenced by my show.
Ken Hanneman and mine as well. Lionel, everyone's crazy except you and me, and I'm not so sure about you. Lionel, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Tom Hartman, thank you so much, my friend.
Keep up the great work. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Speaking of news, Morgan Stanley. This is from Bloomberg. Morgan Stanley, the second biggest U.S. securities firm, told thousands of clients this week that they would not be allowed to withdraw money against their home equity credit lines. That's very interesting. So you go to the bank and you say, I want to have a home equity line of credit. And they say, fine, you got $10,000 or $20,000 or $50,000 or $1,000, whatever it is, in your line of credit. All you have to do is write a check against it, no problem. And then you go out and you negotiate to buy a car or put in a new kitchen or pay your credit card bill or buy groceries. And you discover that the bank says, no. Yes, we gave you the line of credit, but no, we don't have any money. The Financial Times today reporting, and this is, I'm segueing into a different story slightly here, but I think that this is all part of the same thing. The headline is Slump in U.S. Exports Feeds Recession Fears. Well, all the news, you're hearing all this news about how wonderful the economy is right now. There is this this deep rumble underneath it all that is like the sound of the glacier moving across the surface, you know, and you can't quite see the motion, but if you listen very, very carefully. As economists geared up to analyze, this is James Pulte in Washington writing for the Financial Times and today's Financial Times. As economists geared up to analyze the Federal Reserve's interest rate decision yesterday morning, this is where the Fed decided to keep interest rates where they are and everybody celebrated for a few hours. Their attention was grabbed by an unusually worrying indicator on the health of U.S. exports. The Institute for Supply Management's index of new export orders in the services sector dropped by 4.5 percentage points in July. Last Friday, a similar ISM index for manufacturers also fell by 4.5 percentage points. Exports have been booming over the past 18 months, helping to prop up the U.S. economy as it skidded toward recession. So here's the deal. Because we don't have a domestic industry in the United States anymore, because we are following the insane advice of Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan, the late Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan and Friedrich von Hayek and the so-called neoliberals, Robert Rubin. These guys who say, oh, well, you know, the way to be prosperous is just to throw open the doors. Just throw open the doors. No tariffs, no protection, no. You don't want to defend your industries. Are you kidding? That's protectionist. That's wrong. You know, 1960, when John Kennedy was sworn in as president of the United States, the major export of South Korea was wigs made out of human hair. The average income in South Korea was under $400 per year per family. The year John Kennedy was sworn in as president. Today, South Korea competes very effectively, thank you very much, on the world stage against the United States. In fact, they have a surplus and they are exporting more than they're importing. Now, how is that? In the same way Japan did it. You know, Tom Friedman talks about the olive tree and the Lexus. You know, he was on the bullet train eating his bento lunch and thinking about, he'd just been to a Lexus factory and thinking about how, gee, this has got to be free trade at its best, this Lexus. Well, sorry, the Lexus, the Toyota company was turned into a car company with government assistance. The government threw out. In the 1960s, late 1950s, I think it was 57 was the year, the federal government of Japan threw out all foreign car manufacturers. So did the Koreans. And not just cars, electronics as well. And they said, we are going to have a domestic manufacturing base. We're going to have businesses in this country that serve this country, and then we can export our surplus. And that's how it was in the United States from the founding of our country up until Reagan came along. And Greenspan started influencing our international trade policies, and the big multinational corporations got their piece of the action. And now we're seeing that we don't make anything in this country anymore. Walk into a Walmart and find anything made in America. Walk into any, for that matter, I mean, just the first part of that sentence is part of the problem. Walk into a Walmart. Why? Because there's no place else to walk into. I remember living in Montpelier, Vermont, wanting to buy some pillows. And the nearest store I could find within 100 miles was a Walmart that carried pillows. Why? Because all the small businesses had been put out of business. We need to be seriously thinking, and now India has the flip side of this. They're saying you cannot own more than two businesses. Retail. At the retail, a retail store cannot have more than two outlets. So there's one Walmart in India, in the whole country. They're enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act at the level of retail trade. We need to go back to rational things that built this country. Things like the Sherman Antitrust Act break up some of these large corporations so there actually is a level playing field for entrepreneurs who want to get into business and for people who want to start out. And saying, if you want to manufacture something overseas where the labor is cheaper, that's fine. You're going to pay a tax when we bring that into the country that reflects the cost of the labor as if it had been made in the United States. So you might as well make it here. It's what built American industry. It's the only thing that's going to bring it back. Bring back import tariffs. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
but that's not the world I live in. It's not the life for me. My world's bigger than your problems, and it's bigger than me. That's not the world I live in. This is not the life for me. My world's bigger than your problems, and it's bigger than me.
34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Patsy in Faircrest, Washington. Hey, Patsy, what's on your mind today? Welcome to the show. Patsy? Nope. We'll go to Gus in Miami, Florida. Hey, Gus, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm calling because when you mentioned that laissez-faire capitalists and the neocon privateers are basically just trying to set up the government and 401ks and stuff like that for thievery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, recently I found three pirate movies that show the proverbial revolving door between pirates, privateers, and government officials.
Right.
And it's Errol Flynn's Captain Blood and Seahawks, and the best one is The Black Swan with Alan
mm-hmm.
Powers.
Mm-hmm.
And what it turns out is that during peacetime, they're pirates, and because then there's deniability. And during wartime, a lot of them become privateers because they can't have a draft or raise the money. And then if you're a really great pirate, then you can become like the Governor Jacob, which was the Captain Morgan, you know, the guy that had the rum with him on the label.
Yeah.
They gave him governorship of Jamaica after being the most notorious, powerful pirate of the Caribbean.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
That's been going on since Elizabethan times, at least like the 1600s.
Yeah, I've got there's a whole little riff about that actually in my book Unequal Protection, and I was just looking for it because I did it. It's way too long. But anyhow, yeah,
so
this is the anti-piracy law.
The Black Swan with Tyrone Powers, because some of the stuff, if you give names and places and document it, it can go over the head of some folks. But it doesn't get any simpler than watching a really fun pirate movie and seeing the relationship, you know, between these three sets of people.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And in fact, this was, yeah, it was 1681. And yeah, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing that out. In 1681, the British government passed what was called an Act for the Restraining and Punishing of Privateers and Pirates. Okay, 1681. And as trade grew, pirates actually started being hired by the British East India Company. And I believe it was Blackbeard is one of the most more famous ones. And the law said it shall be a felony for any person which now doth or within 4 years last passed heretofore hath or shall inhabit to belong to this island to serve in America in any hostile manner under any foreign prince, state, or potentate in amity with his man. In other words, you were a pirate if you said that you would help out the United States. And then it went on, be it further enacted by the aforethe, blah, 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 that it shall knowingly entertain, conceal, harbor, trade, or hold any correspondence by letter with persons shall be deemed or judged to be privateers, pirates, or other offenders, you know, et cetera. And, they were very, very fluid. And this is, you know, during World War II, Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt were very, very clear about the fact that there were not going to be any war millionaires made as a result of World War II. I mean, they just came right out and said it. And instead, what do we have now? We have, we have war millionaires. We have we don't just have war millionaires. We have war billionaires as a consequence of this war. Point made. And let's move on here. Gloria in Los Angeles. Hey, Gloria.
Oh, hello, Tom. Listen. You have so much influence on progressives, and I wish that you would make a plea to your audience to call Nancy Pelosi, like I did a few minutes ago, and tell her you're not interested in getting them out by anything else, but just forcing them to step down. That includes Bush and Cheney. That would be just like Nixon. There
yeah.
are so many crooked things that they've done. They don't have to rely on this new book. They're already slashing that to pieces. They don't need to do that. But they had this wonderful series a couple of weeks ago of showing all the laws that they've broken. And people have to call Nancy Pelosi and convince her that if they would be forced to step down, she would get in there and thereby avoid having Bush pardon everyone.
Yeah.
That is crucial.
The problem, Gloria, is it's not going to happen. You're not going to be able to force Bush and Cheney to step down. It's not going to happen. And at this point in time,
if you have enough material on them and show them that you're exposing everything and that the PNAC group has been, and their ideology has been running this country, that's almost, those are traitors.
Right. No, I absolutely agree with you. And the key word in the sentence that you just uttered is the word exposing. The prosecution of this, going after these guys, is going to happen in the next Congress, because it's not going to happen in this Congress. And they're actually, we're so late now in the election cycle. I mean, it's fewer than 100 days until the election now.
So
that,
what?
That
if you saw them murder somebody, you'd say, hey, you're going to jail? Or you
I'm not. I am not suggesting that we should not be investigating and, for that matter, prosecuting these people. And you know, I personally believe that even if they were to initiate impeachment hearings today, it would be a good thing and it would work to the benefit of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, however, does not believe that. And they may or may not be right. I don't know. But my point is that we need to hold to make sure that the investigations continue. And it needs to be an investigation series that is the same way that you go after anybody in the mob, and that is you go from the bottom up. Gloria, we need to start out by saying, who are the soldiers? Who are the foot soldiers? Who can we flip? Who are the Sammy Gravello or whatever his name is, Gravano, whatever his name is? Who are the people that we can go in there and we can, you know, Sammy the Bull and say, okay, you're the guy who was the foot soldier for Dick Cheney and or even the foot soldier for the foot soldier. You know, for example, Don Siegelman calling for, let's go after Bill and Laura Canary. Bill Canary was the campaign manager to the guy that beat him. And according to Don Siegelman, they stole the election in the middle of the night in Alabama. Bob Riley, the Republican governor of Alabama. Let's start there. Or let's start with even somebody who works for him. Let's begin these investigations. Let's impanel a special prosecutor. Let's get the stuff in place to begin serious congressional, out in the open hearings after, you know, when Congress recycles, when the new Congress comes in, because unfortunately the Democrats aren't going to do it this time. So, you know, calling up Pelosi's office and saying impeach. You know, I'm all in favor of it, but I even more important, I think, is to contact our members of Congress and say, we want to know that these crimes of this administration, that, for example, Ron Suskind in his new book is revealing, where Bush actually forged a document that was talked about on NBC News to justify the invasion of Iraq, forged a document linking Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. That this is a crime, and this is a crime that will not go unpunished. I really, really strongly believe that if we don't go down that road, then we've got a big problem. And just, you know, just calling and saying impeach now, they'll write you off. I can tell you, I've done it. They will write you off. I've even had the conversations with these politicians. They think they've got it all figured out, and it's all about political equations. And at the same time, it is possible, I believe, to convince them that whether they're going to impeach now or not, gee, we would like that, begin the process of investigating these things and put Henry Waxman on it. And he is on it in many regards. And much of it is flying under the radar and the press isn't reporting on it. And put John Conyers on it. And he is on it, much of it. And put Pat Leahy on it. And let's, as Bernie Sanders says over and over again, let's elect as many true progressives as we can at the level of the House and the Senate. That's where we need to go. Myron in Miami, listening on Wins. Hey, Myron, what's up?
How are you, Tom? So nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
You know, I'm really disappointed with all our representatives because if you stand back and look at it, we're not being represented at all. It's all talk and window dressing, and really nothing goes on. We're losing our country. I think, Tom, we need to have the citizens show what's going on. And we're losing our country slowly, and we need to show them how we're going to lose our country. But we need to be in control of it by going on strike. And it has to be by all of us what we can, by not buying from Walmart, by not filling up the gas tank.
Yeah, all of those individual actions are nice, Myron, but how are you going to not fill up the gas tank if you have to get to work? How are you not going to shop at Walmart if you have to drive an extra 200 miles to buy what used to be sold by five small local companies?
Well,
that
let me tell
anymore.
You what has happened to me without me doing anything. My business is down 75%. I'm a plumbing contractor. I'm the CEO of the business. I'm also the janitor. And I haven't done anything but wake up every morning, have an expensive truck and tools, and buy the best materials, and be a representative of my trade and fix my client's plumbing problems. And my business is down 75%, and I haven't done anything.
No, I'm very sorry to hear that, Myron. And I understand your point, and I think that
the... have to take control somehow, right?
Right. The way to take control is to show up at the Democratic Party meeting and become a delegate, become active, become one of the tail that wags the dog.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at HartmanRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where progressives come to party. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Kathy in Springfield. Hey, Kathy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. It's so nice to talk to you. I've been listening to you for a while, and we lost our Air America station in Eugene, Springfield, so I get you online now, and I'm just glad I found you regardless of how we get it.
Thank you.
I thought it was a interesting comment that Barack Obama made about the whole, you know, Republicans sending out tire gauges and so on, that he just said that in belittling him, the Republicans seem to relish their ignorance. And what I thought was really interesting was I was looking at a Parade magazine from July 4th, and on the front of the parade is John McCain and Barack Obama, and they both made comments about what freedom means to them. Within that same magazine, it says, smart ways to save on gas. And within it, it suggests tune your car up, take care of your tires, keep your tires inflated, and so on. And in this article, it says that if you drive, you know, in responsible ways, which include that, that you can save 80 gallons of gas or more than $320 a year. Multiply that amongst the number of families we have in the country, and suddenly that seems like a pretty reasonable thing to do. So
yeah,
I just thought it was an irony.
Yeah, absolutely, Kathy. This is Barack Obama responding to the McCain ridicule of him.
Fun of a step that every expert says would absolutely reduce our oil consumption by 3 to 4%. It's like, it's like these guys take pride in being ignorant. You know? I mean, they think it's funny that they're making fun of something that is actually true. They need to do their homework. because this is serious business. Instead of running ads about Paris Hilton and Britney Spears, they should go talk to some energy experts and actually make a difference.
There you go. Barack Obama talking about it. So good, spot on, Kathy.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Janice in Pacific Grove, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Janice, what's up?
Hi. It's hard for me to listen to your show. I love your show, but because I'm a teacher, so this is I'm off right now, so I can finally call in. Anyway, a couple of points I'd just like to make is, you know those ads that now with the Britney Spears and John McCain, and he's saying, oh, I'm just having a little fun. Well,
right.
I was thinking how you could really turn that around, and if the Democrats had an ad, and they it would be like taking one of his macaca moments, like that when he does bomb, 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 bomb around, and say, were you just having a little fun with singing this, John McCain?
Right.
And I just think, you know, that might be a good ad. And the other thing I wanted to say is maybe somebody said this before, but I just haven't heard it, about how Karl Rove, you know, he always takes your strength, like with John Kerry, he took the military and then he turned it into a disadvantage.
Right.
Well, you know, it dawned on me that, you know, of course he's taking Obama's popularity. And, you know, normally you wouldn't think how somebody could turn that into a negative. But, I mean, I was just thinking that the other day. And
That's clearly what that's, the, Janice, excellent and well said, and thank you very much for that. That's exactly what they are doing. And here, Paris Hilton responding. We played this at the beginning of the show. I think this is just great.
Hey, America, I'm Paris Hilton, and I'm a celebrity, too. Only I'm not from the olden days, and I'm not promising change like that other guy. I'm just hot. But then that wrinkly white-haired guy used me in his campaign ad, which I guess means I'm running for president. So thanks for the endorsement, white-haired dude. And I want America to know that I'm, like, totally ready to lead. And now I want to present my energy policy for America. Just as soon as I finish reading this article on where I can fly to get the best tan. Oh, Maui. Loves it. Okay, so here's my energy policy. Barack wants to focus on new technologies to cut foreign oil dependency. And McCain wants offshore drilling. Well, why don't we do a hybrid of both candidates' ideas? We can do limited offshore drilling with strict environmental oversight while creating tax incentives to get Detroit making hybrid and electric cars. That way, the offshore drilling carries us until the new technologies kick in, which will then create new jobs and energy independence. Energy crisis solved. I'll see you at the debates, bitches. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go pick out a vice president. I'm thinking Rihanna. I'll see you at the White House. Oh, and I might paint it pink. I hope that's cool with you guys. Bye. I'm Paris Hilton, and I approve this message, so I think it's totally hot.
And what does it mean about the state of Republican political discourse when Paris Hilton's ad makes more sense than John McCain's? Anyway, Carl and Olympia, you wanted to mention a website. We got a little less than a minute here before we wrap up this hour.
Hey, I just wanted to mention that my website, I mentioned to the screener that it was 2,000 links. It's actually 1,100.
Mm-hmm.
It's talking about the psychosis of George W. Bush and various things. You can reach it at carlbond.blogspot.com or just do a Google search of Carl Bond, all one word.
Great. Thanks, Carl. Good luck with it. You know, activism at its very best. We're all out there getting active. Ronnie Deutsch is going to drop by tomorrow, plus Christy Harvey, the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.